You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Emmanuel toko ingoa. Nau mai, hari mai, ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Emmanuel, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Theo. Ewhai akane, coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about the war in Iran and pay equity. I then spoke to Professor Felicity Goodyear-Smith from the Department of General Practice and Primary Healthcare about the crisis in primary care and what can be done to support our GPs. And after that, we'll share with you part of a series of interviews I did with festival organisers, looking to understand why so many were struggling in this current time and how the government overlooked these grassroots local event organisers. He aha o whakaaro, I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces today, so get in touch. Tuku patahi mai, text in on 5395. Kaua e wareware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki anei kōrero anō. Hei pakeheri rukiruki mārunga i te pai. Tukutuku i irirangi, poho mi haere ki 95BFM i rakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
Over the weekend, the US and Israel began conducting bombing strikes on Iran, already killing Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, close to 50 Iranian leaders and hundreds of civilians, including, according to Iranian state media, at least 153 civilians at a school for children between the ages of 7 and 12. The strikes have been met with criticism from experts in New Zealand who have condemned the strikes as illegal under international law. However, Prime Minister Christopher Luxon and Minister of Foreign Affairs Winston Peters have so far expressed neither explicit support nor criticism of the United States and Israel's bombing campaign. Shipping and energy costs have already been impacted by the war, with the costs of liquid natural gas rapidly increasing, demonstrating the risks of the government's plan to build a liquid natural gas terminal in Taranaki to introduce greater vulnerability to price shocks to New Zealand's energy system. Meanwhile, the People's Select Committee on Pay Equity, a coalition of women who formerly served as MPs, published their findings on the government's passing of the Equal Pay Amendment Act 2025, with recommendations that the legislation be scrapped alongside the introduction of a new independent pay equity unit. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, many spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about the Green Party's response to this report, but began by talking about the US-Israel bombing of Iran and New Zealand's role in responding to the conflict.
Kia ora, Ricardo.
Kia ora, thank you for having me this morning.
I wanted to start our conversation today with the big news that's been gripping the media and world attention recently, which has been the war that's begun in Iran. And I want to first hear your opening thoughts on it.
First of all, our thoughts are with civilians across the Gulf who are having their livelihoods being put at risk. And two truths can be possible. The Iranian regime is one that has very little regard for human rights and is a gender apartheid regime, and Iranian people deserve liberation. But Israel and the United States have never been shown to genuinely deliver freedom or democracy through warmongering. And this is why we condemn the unilateral and illegal actions by the United States and Israel to wage war and, through the process, kill civilians who didn't deserve to die and who deserve genuine freedom and peace. And this is why we're particularly concerned about the actions that the U.S. and Israel have taken with no regard to international law.
Now, Chris Luxon, first came out and spoke about this, and he said that New Zealand supported any actions to stop Iran's efforts to obtain nuclear weapons. He's now said he misspoke about that, but that New Zealand does support Australia's policy, which is that they support, in some regard, these attacks, and they certainly condemn the Iranian regime. I want you to know what you think New Zealand should do.
I think most New Zealanders would be shocked to see our own Prime Minister basically trying to be a mini Trump when it comes to foreign policy. We should be our own voice on defending international law, because as a small country, we actually depend on upholding international law to maintain our peace. And Trump, through military action, has not shown, and the United States actually throughout successive governments have not shown to deliver freedom nor democracy to any country they have invaded. And I think Trump needs to summon some courage, some leadership, as opposed to simply trying to impress Trump and uphold international law. And more than anything, the livelihoods of hundreds of civilians who are already being killed. Again, one does not have to defend the horrific Iranian regime, a gender apartheid regime, to see that what Trump and Israel have been doing throughout the past few years is warmongering, is enabling genocide, and in this case, waging a unilateral and illegal war. It didn't work in Iraq, it didn't work in Afghanistan, and I cannot see how this will end up working in Iran either.
Are you surprised at the number of Western states that are not condemning the attacks as strongly as they are condemning Iran's responses?
I'm concerned that we are seeing a growing pandering to Donald Trump at a time where we are seeing the United States administration literally killing its own citizens, putting children in detention camps, and more importantly, trampling over international law. I want to commend the countries that have stood up against Trump, and we're already seeing that they are paying consequences for it. But more importantly, what those countries have shown is that we can stand on the right side of history by both condemning the Iranian regime and calling it for what it is, a gender apartheid regime, while at the same time not enabling Israel and the United States to wage illegal wars and to also call them out for the genocide that they have enabled in places like Gaza.
Just for clarity, which countries would you celebrate in this case?
Well, we're already seeing that Spain is facing the consequences of having a stronger stance on this issue, and Trump's already threatening retaliation for it. And this is particularly concerning because Trump is just using the law of might as opposed to a rules-based order that can genuinely guarantee freedom for people. And when we have huge powers like the United States that disregard international law and international rules-based order, what we end up with is warmongering, is the justification of killing countless of civilians in the so-called name of freedom. And the U.S. has a terrible track record of actually enabling democracies and freedom when they have waged war in the Gulf and the surrounding areas, whether it's the failed war in Iraq, the failed war in Afghanistan, and now what we are seeing is going to be a disastrous consequence for civilians in the war that is being waged in Iran and is now ballooning with war across the region.
And just for our listeners who might not know this, Spain denied the US permission to use jointly operated bases to attack Iran, and this morning Trump threatened to cut all trade with Spain over the dispute. I want to take our conversation in another direction now. I want to keep it about Iran, though. 20% of the world's oil goes through the Strait of Hormuz, which is the South Sea border of Iran. There are huge fears that this is going to wildly increase costs, let alone every other issue that this is going to bring. If New Zealand were to suddenly face huge cost increases and our cost of living crisis were to get worse, how would you confront that if you were in government?
That's right. We are already seeing warning signs that the cost of living could go up because of the warmongering of a few powerful people. And a lot of this is because this government has increased our reliance on fossil fuels as opposed to help build more renewables, help install solar on public homes, public buildings, and marae to ensure that we actually have more energy resilience. And we're already seeing, for example, that the government's crap LNG plan that will end up increasing costs for households is at risk because of this very same war. What we would do instead is solarize the country and ensure that we also invest in our own domestic manufacturing industries so that we are not as vulnerable as we are right now to the warmongering of the US, which threatens literally people's livelihoods here in Aotearoa. And this is why these wars cannot be seen as just a faraway issue. They affect our economy, they affect our ability to make ends meet, and this is why we need to build a resilient economy that is not so dependent on fossil fuels and where we have a robust manufacturing industry that is more resilient to these shocks that happen through war.
It is tied into a more recent story in an RNZ article published yesterday that talks about the risk that this conflict has revealed within the government's LNG plan in Taranaki. Do you have any comment about that?
Well, we've been against this plan for quite some time. It's an expensive plan that will increase energy, basically increase costs for households. And what we are concerned about is that the government is choosing to go ahead with a plan that is now at risk of failing as opposed to doing what we've been told to do by experts and communities for quite some time, which is to take on the gentailers that are making humongous profits, put things like an excess profit tax or actually bring them back into public ownership and to invest in renewable energy so that when the supply of fossil fuels is at risk, we actually have a more resilient economy, but we also do our part to tackle issues like climate change. These things are absolutely possible and within our reach, and all we need is a government that actually stops pandering to big fossil fuel companies and takes the livelihoods of everyday people seriously.
Now, we're running out of time for our next topic, so maybe if I can just get you to quickly summarise the Green Party's position on this now. I've seen you guys and lots of other people talking about the Select Committee report on the People's Select Committee report on pay equity, and also these tensions between whether unions spoke to New Zealand First in time or not, and about what that means for who is the best for workers. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that now.
The Green Party has been clear from the get-go that we will restore pay equity should we be in power, and I think this whole spat between Winston Peters and the unions is all the distraction. Winston Peters knew what the pay equity, scrapping the pay equity regime would do to workers. And also Winston Peters also knows what the new employment laws would do to reduce wages and reduce working conditions for example, everyday low-wage workers. I think this is why Winston Peters needs to be held to account for actively making decisions that makes life harder for everyday people, that increase homelessness, and he cannot pretend that he's not responsible for the increase in rough sleeping that we're seeing in our communities. This is why the Greens will restore pay equity, restore the public housing build program, and have a government that is for the many, not just these guys' wealthy mates.
All right, well, we're out of time, so thank you very much, Ricardo.
No worries, appreciate it.
Have a good morning.
You too, take care.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March on the US-Israel bombing of Iran, New Zealand's role in responding to the conflict, and the Green Party's response to the report published by the People's Select Committee on Pay Equity.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
This is Lydia by King Sweeties. We'll be right back after the break.
The Wire.
Britsky sails into fans' hearts once again with her exquisite new album, Nothing's About to Happen to Me, out now.
Mitski unleashes a forceful tornado of feelings, backed by a full live band and orchestra, to create a deliciously haunting and narrative-driven record.
Nothing's About to Happen to Me by Mitski. Out now wherever good music is found.
Get out your speediest eyewear. The B-Rave is back, and faster than ever before. B-Rave, Friday, March 6th at the Mothership.
Stepping up to the booth for your entertainment is a host of iconic 95 BFM DJs, including Co-Governance,
Rosetta from Breakfast, Nicholas from Drive,
Stinky Jim, Naru, back-to-back babyface killer, Porcelain, back-to-back pros.
Race you there. 95 BFM, Spades, Kira Huketsu, and Under the Radar present B-Rave at the Mothership. Friday, March 6th. Tickets available now at Under the Radar.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
What if you call it?
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
The original originator. Go to 95BFM.com for show podcasts.
Sunday's cloud try behind the door.
Crimson eyes of great
This has been Planet Caravan by Black Sabbath. Before that we had All Tomorrow's Parties by the Velvet Underground. And before the break, we had Lydia by King Sweeties. Welcome back to The Wire on 95 BFM. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309 3879.
The Wire.
Despite general practices representing the backbone of the healthcare system, New Zealand is facing an increasing shortage of GPs, with numbers stagnating or even shrinking as our population increases. As a result, some Kiwis are facing weeks of waiting before they are able to see their general practitioner. Similarly, administrative costs for GPs are ballooning, with many doctors forced to take on a greater number of unpaid hours. A new study has attested to the unprecedented strain faced by general practitioners across six wealthy countries, including Aotearoa New Zealand. However, the study has proposed several whole-of-system solutions to strengthen primary care. To discuss these proposals, I spoke to one of the study's researchers, Professor Felicity Goodyear-Smith, from the Department of General Practice and Primary Healthcare.
Oh, kia ora, Felicity. I want to start us off today by getting your summary of the issues you outlined in your piece. Could you give us just an overview?
Primary care is the sort of care you get from your GP or from maybe sometimes your pharmacist, but it's the first sort of care you get, and most health care is provided in primary care. So it's where you go with all sorts of concerns and issues, and if things are serious enough, then you end up in hospital or secondary care, but most of it's done in the community. Now, we don't have enough GPs. We have a very stretched workforce. General practice in New Zealand is a private business generally that gets some government funding, but it's not the same as hospitals, which are completely funded by the government. There used to be a lot more GPs for the people, but they're all retiring. They're getting very elderly, and not enough new ones have been coming on board. And the ones that do come on board sometimes only work half-time, so right. You need to have more of them. So what happens in New Zealand, but also in other countries, because this is a crisis throughout the high-income countries, is that governments will look at this and they'll say, okay, oh, we need to fix this. We will pay for a whole lot more registrars to be trained, or we will pay for some physician assistants right. to come in and help. And they don't look at the whole system. And so what happens is you get a bottleneck, or you get, it doesn't solve the problem at all. It just looks good for that election cycle. But no one looks at, well, here is the whole system, and what can we do to actually strengthen it and improve it? And rather than just injecting something somewhere and not looking at what the consequences of that are.
Could you go over for us the study that you talked about in your article, the six different countries, and what you found when you looked at their primary care?
We found all of them have insufficient money for primary care compared to the amount of money that goes into secondary care. The money that is used is inefficient. Sometimes things are duplicated. There's not coordination of care. There's no continuity of information being passed between people and over time. And so a lot of money goes in that actually isn't being particularly well used. The money that is given could be allocated so much more efficiently, so that the money you do have, you could actually have joined up services. You could have a team approach. You could look at the whole primary care system and see what is the best way to strengthen the whole delivery of care.
And there was a report I saw out from the Royal New Zealand College of General Practitioners in 2022, the workforce survey, that found that 55% of GPs are looking to retire in the next 10 years. That's a pretty sizable chunk of the workforce. Is this an opportunity to change, or is it a crisis to face?
Well, I think College of GPs and us academics at university, we've been saying for probably 15 years this crisis is coming. And we still have GPs in their 70s because they can't find a GP to take on their practice. They keep working. But, you know, it's been a long time coming. We've known it's coming. It's certainly there's more being trained now and the college is training more. But they, as I say, they're often only going to be part-time workers. And there's still not going to be enough when all this huge cohort of GPs retire. And of course, they're retiring right now, you know.
You spoke about the systemic challenges that is facing the primary care sector, and that the governments need to be looking more at those structural challenges rather than surface level things that look good at an election. What types of structural changes do you think they should be looking at? Do you think it should be to move primary care into Health New Zealand, into Te Whatu Ora, or is there another idea that you have in mind?
It's a good question. I don't know about Te Whatu Ora, but basically there needs to be some overview made of the whole system. And we have a lot more players now. We have not only GPs can prescribe, but some pharmacists can prescribe certain things. Nurses can prescribe some drugs. Nurse practitioners can prescribe. So there is a lot more people who are providing primary care services. And then within general practices, we have a whole lot of other people like health HIPs or health improvement practitioners and health coaches who are assisting. And all these are good things, but there's no one looking at an overview as to how the whole funding primary care in a way that is joined up. And you know, and possibly, yes, possibly we're looking at Te Whatu Ora and GPs on salaries just like every other doctor.
What would the pros and cons of that be, do you think?
I think there'd be a lot of pros, actually, because they would get, you know, they would get all the advantages that the people who are employed like that get in terms of holiday pay and sick pay. And the cons could be that they would lose autonomy and that the secondary care doesn't always understand primary care at all. There could be potentially a loss of practices doing things agilely that they do now. I mean, GPs do an awful lot of things.
Right.
And you wouldn't want to actually stymie that sort of, you know, that flexibility that GPs have.
The independence they get from running their own practice rather than having someone else telling them how to run it, even though they're not involved.
Absolutely,
right.
Yes.
Yes. You've talked briefly about structural changes, different people who can prescribe, nurses that can prescribe and pharmacists that can prescribe, and this idea that more people taking on the workforce in the primary care sector, so nurses with prescriptions, or I've seen talk about physician assistants. There's been some controversy a little bit where some people like them, some people don't like them. Could you give me your understanding of what they are and also your assessment of it?
Well, I mean, it was particularly been a problem in England because they decided there wasn't enough GPs so that they would fund physician's assistants instead. So there's physician's assistants have much less training than a doctor, but they were sort of doing a lot of the same things. And so they funded a lot of these people, put them into practices, and they don't pay them as much because they're not doctors. They don't deliver quite as robust a services, but they actually were doing something when people couldn't see a doctor. But what it meant was that practices were paying the physician's assistants and they could no longer afford to pay GPs. And so there became suddenly a huge number of GPs unemployed because the practices were now absolutely overloaded with all these trained physician's assistants and they couldn't afford to actually have a GP locum. And so the GPs actually stopped being GPs. So this is one of the unintended consequences of putting something in. And I'm not saying that physician's assistants can't be helpful and useful, but there needs to be clear roles and coordination. And I guess one of the other things I haven't said is that when you've got all these new people like pharmacists prescribing, which I think is a great thing, you need to have connected health records. So if a pharmacist prescribes something for a patient, that information needs to go into their health record at the general practice so that the GP knows they've been prescribed that. And there needs to be a coordinated place where all health information can go and really good communication between that pharmacist and that GP. What we have at the moment is a lot of silos. And so we have people working independently, doing little bits. You know, they go to family planning, they get their pill, they go to, lots of different health providers in the community, but there's no one electronic record that can be all coordinated in.
Yes.
And really the role of the GP should be much more of a sort of leading a team, coordinating a team, making sense of the information, but knowing the patient in the full context. So knowing that they're on the pill, knowing that they've been given a drug for gout at the pharmacist, knowing that the pharmacist has done a blood test for that, knowing what the result is. We need a joined-up system. That would save a lot of money and also provide so much better care.
Yes, just like I'm sure some people were probably surprised to hear that GPs are generally private practice, also I'm sure some of our listeners might be surprised to hear that, yes, health records are not universal, they're not on a system, really. There's sort of whispers of efforts to fix this, to sort of unify health records that are across different databases, and there's also been private practice efforts at doing this, or at least running health records, that have led to a lot of leaks. Is that a risk that's just better to take?
There's been lots of work trying to do this with sort of various government groups put together and disbanded, trying to actually create universal records, of records that talk to each other. Doctors pay for their practice management system, that's that, where they put their clinical records. And there are several different practice management systems that they choose. One of them, or a couple of them have associated portals, which is where patients can actually go in and make appointments and see their own records and things. And it was one of those portals that actually, where the leak was recently. So it wasn't actually into the doctor's health records, but it was into the portal. But the portal was allowing information from the clinical records sitting in the portal to be accessed. Not all the portals operate like that. Practice management systems are provided by private companies and GPs have to pay for them. They have to get licenses to use them. So it's quite a big expense for a practice to actually have their practice management system and pay for it. So if there was a universal system that actually also talked wonderfully, if it could talk to the hospital IT system as well, which they do have in some countries like UK and Scandinavian countries, then you would have a lot better coordination of information, and you'd have practitioners being able to work together in a team because they can see what each other's doing.
Have you followed the HERA plan? They were planned to launch a shared digital health record by mid this year. Is it something that you followed, and are you excited for it?
I'm excited if it really happens. That would be wonderful. I don't know what the reality of it is. I haven't really been privy to that.
Well, perhaps we'll have you back on when that comes out to get your assessment of it.
Yeah.
Hopefully, we'll see some positive changes in this area. Do you have any final leaving thoughts that you want to emphasise, anything you want to emphasise?
No, I guess I do want to say that, people in primary care are doing a wonderful job. They work really, really hard. It's not an easy job. You've got people coming with all sorts of issues and problems that they have to sort out. It's not like in hospital where you know that they've come in with abdominal pain and they've got appendicitis. It's, primary care is much more about people coming in with everything. And there's wonderful people out there doing wonderful jobs. All I'm saying is it would be really helpful for everybody if they had better tools to be able to do it.
That was Professor Felicity Goodyear-Smith from the Department of General Practice and Primary Healthcare at the University of Auckland on the problems faced by general practices and the potential solutions for these problems.
How big is his hole? And do...
That is not in the public interest, I can assure you.
The Wire.
This is... Go To by Eerie. We'll be right back after this break.
Thank you. Take the loot, but Billy won't be bothering anymore. cash, couple of cash. Do you want it in your chest or your knees or your head? DJ Proofy has the lead. You can beg, you can plead, you can tell us what we need. You can change your name, but you're all a fucking sim.
That was HOOD by Kneecap, and before that was Go To by Eerie. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
It's time for a short from this week's episode of Beeline, your 95BFM news podcast, delivering straight-up news.
In last week's episode of our news podcast, Beeline, I spoke to festival organisers to get their perspective on the issues that they've had to face and what's next for their festivals. Over the past few years, a host of our festivals have gone on hiatus, wound down or threatened to wind down if things don't change. At the same time, the government announced a major events fund aimed at bringing in tourists, yet it has been criticised for overlooking these local events organisers after local festivals Splore were rejected from the fund and have since thrown their last festival. This is organiser of Splore, John Minty, and head of marketing at Om Festival, Rob Warner, discussing these events with me.
With festivals facing this tough moment at this point in time, spending is down, costs are up. In a case like this, could the government have done more to support Splore?
Yeah, I honestly believe that. I mean, I have been running my own company for over 40 years. I'm not into handouts, and I believe that a private enterprise company, you take the risk, you know, you lose or you win. But having said that, with the struggles with all of our cultural things, you know, whether it's a live music venue or whether it's a dance troupe or a festival, particularly a festival like a Splore or an Om or a WOMAD, where they are actually very iconic cultural events. It's not just an international artist playing on a stage for a few hours and everyone goes back to a hotel. You know, these are communities that have been evolved. Like Splore has been going 28 years, so we're into three generations. So it's a massive cultural event, and I would argue that something like Splore, where we have a lot of non-commercial elements to our program, like our artwork, whare tapiri with the local iwi, our workshops for children, spoken word, all that's non-commercial. So I think those elements of a festival, which WOMAD have, I think have a good case to be funded. You know, the non-commercial, not so much money from the government to be able to afford an international artist to come down from England with all the money heads off overseas. Splore generates about $3 million. 90% of that goes to local community, all local contractors. Our international artist budget is relatively small, so we're pumping a lot of money into the economy. As I say, international visitors that come to Splore say this is the most amazing festival. So it showcases New Zealand, it showcases our indigenous culture. Why wouldn't the government want to support something like that? You know, they just put millions into, you know, sponsoring getting the surf tournament down to Raglan from Jay Bay, which I'm a fan of. I'm a massive surfer, so I don't have a massive problem with that. But they are spending millions to do it. And I'm thinking, well, hang on a minute. That's just one event at Raglan for surfing, which I love, don't get me wrong. But, you know, even a fraction of that amount of money for Splore would have probably had more impact in terms of international visitors and the impact on perception of New Zealand.
I've seen you speak in other interviews about this government fund that they launched this year. That, you know, you mentioned the Raglan Surf. Another one that you brought up before was Linkin Park receiving subsidized $800 tickets. I'd love for you to speak on this here. How do you feel about that?
I think the government, I think it was a knee-jerk reaction. I felt there was some pressure from the industry that the government had to do something. The governments, state and federal in Australia, also in England, they have been providing good funding for festivals because they understand the importance of that culture. And I think the current government felt there was a bit of pressure to actually do something. And I think that the money, they had $70 million. And I think the events they supported, I think a lot of it had a bit of a political overtone to it. I don't think they thought it through in the sense that the money they were pumping in there wasn't going to attract international visitors. If that was the basis of the funding, there's not international visitors going to come to see Ultra in Wellington or Lincoln Park in Auckland. I mean, they're doing shows all around the world. So where's the rationale there? I'm not bad-mouthing, and I think that government should support all those sort of events, but I think they needed to be a bit more selective. And they did, in fact, sponsor and provide money for a lot of cultural events. I think the Taranaki Light Festival might have got some funding, for example. So there were quite a few that did get funding, which I would have thought that's fine. But I think, you know, your grassroots festivals that are doing it hard because they don't have international backing. These are locally owned, entrepreneurial young people trying to make a difference and create a culture here. And all the money is going back into our local community. And I think they're the sort of events that government should be funding. And we've gone for central government funding before over the last few years, and we've never got it, which I find quite surprising.
There are people out there who would make the case that we wouldn't have as many artists and musicians were it not for the grassroots festival scene, giving them that space to grow and find an audience.
Yes, yes, and this is a point I've made many times before, is that the smaller grassroots events feed up into the music ecosystem by helping people get this experience or exposure, whereas larger events do not feed down. They don't support the small artists in any meaningful way. They don't support nurturing artists. They don't support the ecosystem. It is a financial transaction and consideration, and that's it. And that's why I always distinguish events into things that are arts and culture focused and things which are checkbook and balance sheet focused. And it's an important point to make that when you see large events crying out for money, they are not supporting grassroots culture or growth or new artists. And they leave all that heavy lifting to all of the smaller events who take larger proportional risks all the time. And they do it out of love for music and art. And at some point, if they start falling over, then you end up with bland corporate events only dominating the market space. And that's not good for anything.
How much of a personal financial risk grassroots organisers putting themselves at to host a festival if it doesn't go well?
It's a huge risk because, like I say, there's a lot of costs involved in doing a festival. Generally, they start in New Zealand like Sproul started. We all just got in together. We didn't pay ourselves any money. We got all our friends to help out. And that's pretty well the only way you can do it. You've got a mate with a good PA. And that's why most underground festivals start. But then, you know, you might get a bit of demand and you sell a few tickets and then then people go, well, I've done this for free for the last 5 years, can I have some money now? And then it becomes a bit of a crunch.
That was Director of Sproul John Minty and Head of Marketing at OMM Festival Rob Warner discussing the events industry and their views on government events funding. This was just a clip from the 10th episode of our news podcast, Beeline. If you want to listen to the whole episode where we speak in more depth to John and Rob along with a host of other organisers and check in on Twisted Frequency and what can be done to support it so it doesn't end, you can listen to this episode on 95bfm.com and our other 10 episodes.
Whew, that was short. That was a short from this week's episode of Beeline. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hotaka katoa mo tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I koeroa mai ki matou mo tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. Thank you to all of our guests today, the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March, Professor Felicity Goodyear-Smith, and John Minty and Rob Warner. Nei rā hoki te mihi, kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The Wonderful.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.